And so usually I like to read from my own notes. And this time I'm going to read from other people's notes. There are three explorations of Esther that I love, and we are in the holiday of Purim. And I love the words of these three interpreters of Esther, explorations of Esther. So let's find it. So welcome to Purim. We're in the year 5784, living the moment that Haman convinces the king, Ahasuerus of Shushan, that the Jews are evil and must be destroyed. That is uncomfortably resonant in our current moment. So here are the three teachings that I love to reread each year on Purim. And the first is by Rabbi Sharon Annisfeld Cohn, the president of Hebrew College Rabbinical School. And she writes, "I have come to believe that the most important verse in the entire Megillah, the verse that represents the pivotal turning point in the Purim story, is when Mordechai sends a message to Esther, urging her to reveal her identity to King Ahasuerus and plead on behalf of the Jewish people. Remarkably, Mordechai's message to Esther hinges on two simple words that promise nothing and changes everything. And the words are mi yodea, who knows? Mi yodea im la'et kazot higa'at la'malchut. Who knows if it wasn't for just such a time that you became queen?" These words set Esther in motion. They inspire her to take action, despite of her own resistance, in spite of her fears about her own fate, in spite of her doubts about her own position and power in the king's court. Who knows? This is hardly the kind of message we look for to motivate us to act with courage in crisis. We generally look for a message that inspires a little more confidence, like, "This is why you became queen," or, "Your actions will make a difference." But the world of Purim is not unlike our world. It's a world without guarantees, without certainties, or signs from God. It's a world in which we don't know, can't know the limits or possibilities of our own power. It's a world in which we can't be sure where our actions will lead and whether our efforts will be for naught. It's a world in which, if we are able to discern God's presence at all, it is through our own faltering attempts at courage and compassion. Often, when we say, "Who knows?" it's accompanied by a gesture of resignation, as if not knowing relieves us of responsibility. For example, how can we effectively respond to climate change? Who knows? It's too complicated for me to get involved. Who knows what I could do to make a difference? And all too often in our own lives, who knows becomes a pretext for paralysis. But in this remarkable exchange between Mordechai and Esther, something quite different happens. Who knows becomes not an excuse, but an invitation. Consider the possibility, says Mordechai, that you are here for a reason, that there is something bigger and more important than your fear, that you have more power than you imagine. Consider the possibility that it is up to us to act out of love and responsibility for each other, to make room for God's presence in this world. Esther's willingness to get to act on the possibility is what makes her a prophetess, according to Midrashic tradition. When she enters the king's court, she is terrified, and yet prepared to risk her own life. The Megillah says, she clothed herself in royal garments. But the linguistic idiosyncrasy in the verse leads the Gemara to suggest that what was really happening was that she clothed herself in the Shekhinah. This is prophecy from the ground up, not a heavenly voice intruding in human affairs, but a human being full of doubts, yet determined to bring God's presence down to earth. In some ways, I think that our practice that describes our practice, an aspect of our practice. So next line is, who knows if it wasn't for just such a time that you became queen? Mordechai and Esther bequeath to us a dual legacy of humility and hope, of radical uncertainty and radical responsibility. What are our obligations on this holiday of Hester Panim, the hiddenness of God's face? And as you probably know, Esther, the root of Esther's name is hiddenness. It's that we take care of each other. We send each other treats. We expand our circle of concern and send gifts to the poor. Through small acts, we choose interdependence over isolation, responsibility over despair. We turn toward each other in the face of uncertainty and toward love in the face of fear. So now I'm going to shift to another great teacher for me, Rabbi Erwin Keller. And this is from his article, Robed in Malchut. And the subtitle is The Hidden and Revealed in Esther and in Us. So he begins, as one of the very few rabbis serving a Reconstructionist congregation who can also boast a 2-decade career as a professional drag queen, I have something to say about Purim, about the topsy-turviness of it and the prevalence of disguise in both the story and our celebration of it. The book of Esther is indeed filled with disguise and disclosure. The most famous here is Esther, our Jewish hero who wears a disguise that does not involve a mask, but rather an omission. She does not reveal her ethnic affiliation. The text says she's commanded this by her cousin Mordechai. But I suspect Esther clearly sees the strategy and purpose here, and the Hebrew text just happens to catch Mordechai's mansplaining. So Esther remains a closeted Jew as she rises to the position of the queen of Persia. But here's the thing about disguise. While it conceals, it also reveals. At least this is my professional opinion, having spent 21 years on stage as Winnie of the Kinsey Six, and that's spelled S-I-C-K-S, America's favorite drag a cappella beauty shop quartet. Winnie was somewhat unlike me. She was proper. She was stern. She was a lesbian. That said, there was a part of me that got expressed through Winnie that had no other place to reveal itself. There were things I could say, freedoms I could embody, that were much harder in pants. In my thousands of hours as Winnie, I was able to live outside of my assigned gender. No one believed me to be a woman, and that wasn't the point. But I didn't have to live up to anyone's standard of masculinity either. I was free of the corset-tight gender binary, free to be myself, graceful and awkward, confident and anxious, erudite and bumbling, fully at home in my skin, that's good too, my skin, or in hers. We typically talk about Esther's disguise as a kind of lessening. She wasn't her full self because she had to hide her Jewish identity. But what might Esther have actually been revealing while she was living in this supposed disguise? Esther comes to embody her authority as queen. She holds and uses power. She's not pretending to be the queen of Persia. She is the queen of Persia. When she determines her plan for rescuing the Jews, she doesn't need Mordechai or anyone else to devise or execute it. She has learned statecraft. And when she commands the Jews to fast with her for 3 days, it's not a desperate petition to win God's favor. Her task is one to which she is more than equal. And her prayer and her fasting are to make sure that she approaches her task with humility. This side of Esther, the part that holds and manages power confidently and humbly, is a part of Esther that probably never would have been expressed had she not come into the palace in her non-Jewish disguise. Esther, the Esther who would have lived her life out in the Jewish quarter of Shushan, might never have had the opportunity to know how powerful she was. There's one key spot in the book of Esther where the text hints at Esther's true power. And it's one of the two fashion-related moments. In the story, we touch on Esther's wardrobe twice. Once is when she becomes engaged, and Ahasuerus sets on her head a royal diadem. In Hebrew, a keter, malchut, crown. The second time is later, leading into the story's climax, when she goes unbidden to see the king to launch her campaign to save the Jews. In her preparation, the text tells us, Va'tilbosh Esther malchut. Esther wears malchut. Malchut is the common Hebrew word for kingdom, both in the physical sense and in the more abstract meaning of kingship or royalty. And in the book of Esther, the word Malchut is mostly used to refer to Ahasuerus's realm or his sovereignty. But what does it mean to say Esther wore Malchut? It's an odd formulation. Translations of the book of Esther say she wore royal garments, but the text doesn't actually say garments, as it could have. Instead, in the simple language of the text, it was Malchut itself she was wearing. In Talmud, Rabbi Hanina interprets Malchut here to mean Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Divine Spirit. And that's from B.T. Megillah 15a. While Esther's tribal affiliation remains hidden, there's something of the divine that is revealing itself through her. When she enters the king's chamber, there's a gross trivialization to say she's beautiful. Instead, in Rabbi Hanina's view, she is literally a revelation. Our mystical literature loves this moment because the array of meanings and associations that the concept of Malchut has in Kabbalah. In our mystical understanding, the source of all is an undifferentiated infinite oneness, an undifferentiated divine, a tree of life that posits a 10-point process through which divinity differentiates, refines, reshapes itself in order to form and enter this world of separation. The first node or sphera of the divine tree of life is Keter, or crown. This is the divine flow that represents something very abstract, a generative ripple of divine will. I love that phrase, a generative ripple of divine will. From there, the divine energy flows from sephira to sephira until it reaches the 10th sephira that is Malchut. Now Malchut represents the divine that is transformed and physicalized into countless beings and objects, wave and particle. Malchut is the world as we know it, but with the added awareness that underneath the illusion of all this separateness and physicality, there is the truth of an infinite and permeating divine. An infinite and permeating divine. So Malchut is this earth, and Malchut is the divine energy that penetrates and pulses through it. Malchut is the divine presence that we can perceive in this earthly realm that we call Shekhinah. And Shekhinah, or Malchut, is us as well, the assembly of the people of Israel, which we can perhaps read expansively as being all of humanity. So when Esther sweeps into the king's chamber wearing Malchut, she is the earth. I never get through this without crying. She is the earth, and she is the Shekhinah. She is Ahasuerus's kingdom and God's as well. She is power and sovereignty. She is the majesty of all creation. She is the collective of all of us. Her robes are no fashion statement, unless as a statement by no less than the fashioner of all creation. When Esther enters the king's rooms, arrayed in the light of Shekhinah, King Ahasuerus has no choice but to see. Brave and confident, Esther was channeling something big and luminous. The question asked of Esther impresses itself on us as well. We are not powerless. Each of us have come into Malchut, into this complex, glorious, fragile, wounded, and still God-soaked world. I just realized why I cry. I mean, I've said this many times and cried many times. And I think it's like I picture myself as a small girl learning about Esther, whose emphasis is on how she looks, that she's beautiful, and how she looks to the king and how others see her. So to flip it like this is a gift for me. So I'm going to end this talk with words of another woman in our history who did not survive Auschwitz. And her name is Etty Hillesum. I'm sure many of you have heard of her, a Dutch Jewish woman. And in the midst of annihilation, she brings light and love to Nazi death camps. She had the option to hide and escape, but chose instead to accompany her people into the camps and in the process become a source of love and compassion and companionship. My source for her words come from the work of Palestinian, Arab, and Israeli Jewish women who together compiled her words onto cards that you can make a contribution and receive. And here is their challenge to us in Etty's words. Not thinking, but listening to what is going on inside you. If you do that for a while, every morning, before you start work, you can acquire a kind of calm that illuminates the whole day. Begin each day like that, until the last shreds of worry and petty thoughts have been swept out of your head. Just as you sweep your room clean of dust and cobwebs each morning, so you can clean yourself inwardly every morning. Time and again, I've learned how spacious the heart can be. Time and again, I've had to reclaim that space. Living and dying, sorrow and joy, the blisters on my feet, and the jasmine behind the house, the persecution and the unspeakable horrors, it is all as one in me, and I accept it all as one mighty whole. Or maybe holy holiness. The realms of the soul and the spirit are so spacious and unending that this little bit of physical discomfort and suffering really doesn't matter all that much. I do not feel I've been robbed of my freedom. Essentially, no one can harm me at all. Now in my words, this seems to me as if she's living min hametzer karati Yah, from the depths I call out to Yah. Anani vamerkav Yah, and God answers me with spaciousness. Ma'aseli Adam, what can another person do to me? Now she continues, truly, my life is one long hearkening unto myself and unto others and unto God. Like we say in the Shema, hear or listen. It is really God who hearkens inside me, the most essential and deepest in me, hearkening into the most essential and deepest in the other. God to God. And she says, give your sorrow all the space and shelter in yourself that it's due. For if everyone bears her grief honestly and courageously, the sorrow that now fills the world will abate. But if you do not clear a decent shelter for your sorrow, and instead reserve most of the space inside you for hatred or thoughts of revenge, then sorrow will never cease in this world and will multiply. She continues, ultimately, we have but one moral duty, to reclaim large areas of peace within ourselves, more and more peace, to reflect it towards others. And the more peace there is in us, the more peace there will also be in our troubled world. And that's the end of her readings. It's not the end of her readings. She has a book that you can read that's pretty amazing. But those are, I had difficulty choosing. Those are the verses. So let's be silent for a moment. And then we'll open and hear about your thoughts, your sorrows, your strivings, your insights, and your confusion.